I'm Anthony Bachman from All Things Good and Nerdy, a geeky podcast part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other fantastic geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And welcome to Play Comics, the show where we look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. Except for times like this, where once again, I have another creator bonus episode because I know a cool person who makes cool stuff. Today, we've got Carl Antonowitz, who makes some really cool stuff.
Hello!
So Carl, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Chris. How about yourself?
I'm doing really good too, especially because I get to talk to you about the cool stuff that you make.
Aw, you're too sweet. So, Chris, I met you at SwanCon down in Sumter, South Carolina this year.
For anybody who doesn't know where that is, don't worry about it.
It's inland, about 2 hours from the big city in South Carolina.
Yes, the one big city that South Carolina has.
Charleston? Is that what it is?
It is. That is where I am. Some people say Columbia is a big city, but I think that Columbia is garbage.
Well, I can't weigh in on this one. I don't think I've been to Columbia. But sure, man. Hell with them. So one of the things that I do, and also one of the things that I think was the reason that you asked me onto the podcast, Chris, is performance comics, or comics as performance.
That's it, because this is something that I don't even know if I'd ever thought of this as a possibility outside of, like, let's read lines sitting around a table.
So the what I do is, like, try to make a translation between the page and the stage. Like, my comics, the way that I write comics tends to be, like, very character driven. There's a lot of people talking to each other, and a lot of people like only very occasionally stabbing or bludgeoning each other. A lot of riding horses, though. There's a fair amount of horse riding. And so what my practice as it stands now involves is doing, like, voices for these characters in a performance setting, doing like sound effects, like live Foley effects with various pieces of fruit and or other objects. Like, I think, what all did I use in the one that you saw?
Like I know there were some leaves rustling around.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that really stuck out in my mind was an old pair of Chuck Taylors.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so like leaves, gravel, in a few cases like a box of dirt, broken glass sometimes, fruit, vegetables, water, like a bunch of things that have very distinct sounds and can reproduce sounds that are happening on the page. It's sort of like a radio play almost, but with more, I'd say, a roughly equal amount of theatricality, but more visuals than a radio play tends to have.
Yeah, because, I mean, this was something that Kaylee and I just kind of stumbled into when my mom invited us down to stay with them to go see all the SwanCon stuff. So we went into this really not having any expectations at all, not really having any idea what we were getting into. And holy crap, is it just really cool.
Thank you. So I performed with with Noah Van Sciver, who is a friend of mine and also a really, really accomplished and very prolific graphic novelist, and my wife, Sophie Goldstein, who is a, I guess she's a friend of mine too, but she's also my wife, and is also a very talented graphic novelist. So the three of us did, Noah did one piece. I think we did a couple of pieces of Sophie's. Sophie and I together did a couple of her pieces, and I did a longer piece that I had finished like 3 or 4 years ago called Until the Blood Runs Black. And this was the first time that I had done this piece completely solo or in its entirety. I have no idea how long it lasted. I don't think anybody taped it or anything. But there was a lot of like squelching and a lot of like inward demon voice.
Yeah, that part was really cool.
I'm glad you liked that. It was really rough on the instrument.
The small child in the row in front of us looked like he was gonna cry.
Good. I used to do a lot of slam poetry, and I did this poem about my old truck called My Truck is a Death Machine, which had at one point did bring a child to tears in fright, which was not my intent, but I'll take it. So yeah, there's a lot of like, at least in Until the Blood Runs Black, and in the longer piece that I finished last year called Where's Kiss, there's a lot of sort of vocal gymnastics, and a lot of like pretty heavy demands being placed on the performers, like both on them vocally and physically. The project that I did last year, how much of this did I tell you about, Chris?
I don't think you told me about the one last year.
Well, you've got the book version of that. So Chris was very kind and bought both the first and second part of my comic Boy's Kiss, which is a two-parter because I hadn't finished the second part by the time the show debuted. But that was, I had gotten this grant from a theater in Pittsburgh. I was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at the time. I had gotten a grant from the New Hazlett Theater in Pittsburgh. That's NEWHAZLETTHEATER.org. They have a series called the CSA series, which is community-supported art. So people will put in applications, and they will accept like 5 or 6 of them. And every other month, they'll have one of these applicants debut one of the people that they've selected debut a performance on their pretty large professional stage. And like the grant also includes a stipend. There's access to their like institutional support, their facilities. You can make use of their, you can hire people to design your lights and your sound and all that kind of jazz. And you can you can put together a professional show. And so I managed to get this grant, and the end result of that was I told this story about leprosy, essentially, about othering, about loosely inspired by a very specific event involving lepers in northeastern Spain and the south of France in the 13th century. Which is like, it's such a weird medium and a weird project to talk about, simply because it's all the things are very specific with it. Does that make sense? Am I talking sense here?
No, you are. I mean, what made you go with this event though, or you know, leprosy in general? Because it seems like such an kind of out of the way topic in today's world. You know,
I mean, for the West, yeah. It's a very out of the way topic. A proper cure for leprosy wasn't really discovered until like the 50s. And there is still parts of the world where leprosy is endemic, if not epidemic. The thing about that really drew me to this event. This is the Leper's Plot of 1321, as you can imagine. In this event, to cut a long story short, a number of people raided these leper colonies, which at the time were administrated by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was like, no, you can't really do that. Those are ours. And the fellas who had raided these were like, no, we found evidence here, looking around suspiciously. We found evidence here that these lepers were conspiring with the Jews and the Muslims and other people that we don't like because they're not like us to poison wells in our towns and make everybody into lepers. Which obviously untrue. And the Catholic Church was like, oh, whoa. And so around 100 to 150 lepers were burnt at the stake over the course of this year. And then the next year, something else horrible happened. But this particular thing really, really jumped out to me because it's such propaganda, Mispa. Like there's no evidence that people, there's no like real evidence in the record that was produced by the people who raided these leper colonies. None. It was entirely hearsay. It's a lot like the way that Pizzagate, if you remember that old chestnut, was. Pizzagate, for those of you who are not in the know about this, was a equally baseless accusation on the part of, like, who was it? Like, Glenn Beck or somebody?
I don't even remember because it was that dumb.
It was a conspiracy theory on the part of a few really conservative figureheads that Hillary Clinton and a bunch of other Democratic politicians were involved in a child prostitution ring, which was nominally located underneath this particular pizza shop in DC. This is obviously entirely fabricated. Like, it's not, it just didn't happen. There's no evidence that it happened. There's nothing to suggest that it happened. It's like an entire, it's a baseless lie, which resulted in a kind of unhinged man, like, unloading a couple of clips inside this pizza shop, and hoping to free the children who were trapped underneath it. So, like, that kind of lie, that kind of baseless propagandism, still happens. It happened then, it still happens. And, you know, things that people say have have weight, especially when you have bunches of people listening to you. Chris.
I know. What can you do?
You just gotta be responsible, bruh. Anyway, that was my starting point with Puer's Kiss. And I'd sort of like rolled around in this shared universe setting thing that I have called the Rude Lands. Most of my stories, including the one you saw performed, Chris, most of my stories of the last like 5 or 6 years have taken place in that setting. I don't know if did I get lost there?
In the best way possible.
Sweet. So leprosy. It still exists, one. Two, it's not a thing that people think about a lot. Three, I really like drawing boils and like disfigured bodies. And there's a lot of great photo reference for leprosy.
I really like how you hit the most important reason there right at the end.
I mean, I could have led with that, but the other part of it was also, like, you know, morals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do, like, I draw a lot of disfigured bodies, like the concept of the grotesque body, especially in a medieval setting, is one that has a lot of power for me.
And I mean, the artwork in it is beautiful. I'm flipping through it right now.
Oh, thank
and
you.
I mean, there is absolutely no question who has leprosy going on, who has super extreme leprosy going on. Like, the how did my wife get through this page leprosy.
is your wife squinked out by, like, oils?
She usually isn't into horror kind of things, but she kept looking at these. And, like, at one point, I could get the second volume away from her, but I'm not going to read that before I read the first one.
I mean, there's a little recap of the first volume in the front of the second volume, but it's, I think it's better to read them in sequence, in my humble opinion.
Well, I managed to sneak them away from her, so she's just not going to get them back until I read them now.
I got this grant to do this show. I managed to write the printing of the first book into the grant. So for the debut of the show and the second show that I did at that theater, I was able to just, like, give away the copies of the first book. And that was really gratifying. It was very important to me that people who bought the tickets to this were able to take the ride later on, you know? But like I said, the art for the second part wasn't finished at the time when I had to when it was time to debut, you know. So I had to do I performed the entirety of the story, like both first and second parts, with my actors, and the but like a lot of the second part was in pencils. But damn, people seemed okay with it.
I mean, it's totally worth it, you know?
Mm. And so, yeah, so, like, doing this show really changed the direction that I wanted to take my career, such as it is. It's a lot more fun. You can reach a lot more people with it. I mean, I still love drawing comics. I love telling stories in this medium. I love, believe it or not, I love inking. Inking is, like, one of my raison d'etre, if you will. And the, yeah, like I jumped back into doing this comic that I had put on hold in order to do Boris Kiss. As soon as we moved out here.
So your original vision of this show, was it always in your brain, like, kind of show the comic, but then the Foley work and everything else below that on the stage?
Yeah. Did I link you to the YouTube video?
You did, and there will also be a link to that in the show notes.
Oh, cool. Dear listener, I highly recommend you click on that. Pause us and come back in a minute. The way that worked, I had originally sort of envisioned the art being projected on three screens, which I found out later on, after some talks with some technical people, is insane. it didn't seem that insane when I first thought about it. I thought of the idea of, like, having each panel in a tier. I was working in a 3x4 grid, so like a 12 panel page. And I was thinking that each panel in a tier being projected on a separate screen that would sort of, like, cuff the audience. like the almost the reverse of a thrust stage, if you're familiar with the shapes of stages.
I'm not, but I'm assuming that's one where the stage juts out into the audience.
Yep, hence the name. It would sort of like cup the audience. I can draw you a diagram for this or something if you need it, but I think you get it.
I think we can get it.
Yeah, so it would be three screens like that, and then have the Foley, the tables for the Foley effects set up, like, you know, parallel to each one of those screens in that same sort of cup pattern. But again, like, that's insane. Like, projecting on three screens like that was a greater difficulty technically than I was prepared to address. So, you know, after a lot of hemming and hawing, I eventually just decided that I was going to do it on the single screen. And that worked out definitely in my favor. I learned, like, there was so much that I learned from working with, like, the professionals that I was able to work with through this grant process. Like, I didn't really have any knowledge of projection. I didn't really have any knowledge of video editing. I knew about putting lines on paper. I knew about telling other people to say things just so. And that was it. You know, so, like, I learned about the industry standard projection software, projection and video software, QLab. I learned about doing, like, how to embed videos in that alongside still images. I learned a lot about Foley work. For the uninitiated, Foley work is the art of creating sound effects through the use of non-related or possibly disparate objects. Like, for example, I don't know, crunching celery to do bones breaking, or like how in Star Wars the sound of the TIE fighters is an electric razor being rubbed on the inside of a metal mixing bowl.
I didn't know that one, but it actually makes so much sense.
Right? You just, like, you wouldn't think of it. There's a lot of, you have to be very creative when making Foley effects. I was lucky enough to work with Zach Brown, not of the Zach Brown band, Zachary Beattie Brown, who is really, really good at making live Foley effects up, and just like a sweet man. So he taught me everything that I know at present about Foley. And yeah, so, like, it was such a huge learning experience, and my vision for it changed a lot. As you'll see in the video, dear listener, there is a lot of downstage action in Boyer's Kiss. Like, there's things that happen outside of, like, in front of the Foley things, which is, I think, the thing that makes this performance unique from certain other performances that are in a similar vein. There is some interaction physically between the voice actors and themselves. This physical interaction between the voice actors. They're almost portraying, but also commenting on the action happening on the screens in the panels. And that's, I don't know, I haven't seen that anywhere before. That happened almost entirely by accident. So there's a part in the book, which was in the stage show until I realized it wasn't working, where the main character, Felicia, has to drag her charge, who is a man named Ibn, around by his hands. He has no legs. And because the art for that was not entirely finished at the time that we began rehearsals, one of the other voice actors, Ryan, suggested that he and the main voice actress, Joanna, act this out. And I was like, I mean, sure, okay, yeah, go for it. That's going to help you understand it. And then they did it, and we integrated that into the blocking for the show. And it totally changed the way that it worked. There's a lot more, it doesn't feel as presentational, I guess, as it might otherwise. Like there's another show, touring company called the Intergalactic Nemesis. Have you heard of these guys?
I've not.
They're wonderful. They do, this almost like Star Wars-y, kind of serial. Like it's a radio serial that's also a graphic novel series. And so like they'll go to a large performance hall. I saw them at a big theater in Pittsburgh. I can't remember which one. So I saw them there, and it was incredible. Like there's a professional Foley artist, there's professional musicians, the voice actors who are there are also professionals. It's just very good. It's a very impressive thing. But the voice actors are standing like behind these microphones and like they're gesticulating, their arms are moving, they're like making faces and stuff the way that you have to as a voice actor. But they're not like moving very much. All of the focus from the audience is pretty much on either the Foley table or the art, which is projected on a screen behind them. The different part about this, about Boris Kiss, is that the actors are also doing the Foley stuff. There's not a separate person who is explicitly devoted to that. Like the three of us were crunching leaves, throwing rocks and breaking sticks and stuff. Like with our own hands rather than there being somebody else who is involved in that. And then there was this constant motion behind the Foley tables and then in that staging area out in front that I was mentioning. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like too much in love with this project. Like there's definitely things about it that I would change if I had the opportunity. And there are definitely things that I know could be improved upon by more capable hands than mine. But I think it's a pretty unique thing. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
No, I mean, I definitely haven't. I mean, you got me curious now. What do you think could be better?
No, there's some like transitions that I have always felt were like, maybe that could be better. I'm not the best at writing jokes. And there's a lot of jokes, there's a lot of body humor in Where's Kiss. I talked with my friend Heidi Nagel. Shout out to Heidi if you're listening to this one, buddy. About where to put jokes in, what kind of jokes to put in, how can we make this as opposed to just being like a moralistic screed, how can we make this into something that is enjoyable on like a humorous level? Like like an M. Night Shyamalan movie, right? Like he has some ideas, but he does not have a funny bone in his body. You know, like you look at his version of Last Airbender, right? You look at that and
I mean, that's not possible because it doesn't exist, but we can talk about that theoretical movie.
It's not canon. So imagine if M. Night Shyamalan, for example, had made a multi-million-dollar flop called The Last Airbender based on the children's the children's franchise of the same name. Imagine that, if you will. Shyamalan doesn't have a funny bone in his body, and like him choosing him to direct this movie based on a children's property that has so much spirit and so much like humor in it was an abominably bad decision on the part of the studio, and it also made it unwatchable. Like the dour, joyless, plodding nature of that film really like it really sucked the life out of that story. And I didn't want to do that. You know, like I've written a couple of books that don't have any jokes in them, or the jokes in them aren't funny to anybody but me. Which does that count as a joke still? I don't know. But they were very serious. They were very, very earnest, in a way that I think is sort of kind of a bit of a turnoff, you know? And I don't want to sit through a performance of something that it takes itself so seriously that there's no joy in it.
No, I totally get that, though. I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed in watching the video of your thing, of this one, and then seeing it again the next day for some different stories, was just how into the story all of the actors were having to be. Because, you know, they're up there on the stage, everybody can see them. You know, they can't just hide behind the fact that somebody's going to show them the comic and nobody's going to see the actor later. They have to actually be into the story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had such good luck with my actors. There were a couple of folks that I knew from various other enterprises. Like my main actress, Joanna Becker, I had worked with in a crepe shop of all places. Shout out to Cafe Merlin. And she was a performer. She's a singer and aerialist, and yeah, just a real sweetheart. One of my best friends in Pittsburgh. And the other voice actor, Ryan, I met through a mutual acquaintance, a mutual friend, Stacey Fedoroff, who I later on would end up living with, or so Sophie and I would end up living with, and. Yeah, so they just they both gave so much. Like you saw how Ryan at a certain point had to have, I think it was maybe a three-way conversation with himself, and then stab himself.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Yeah, like Ryan is such a superstar. He shouldered so much weight in that performance and did such an amazing job. I am very proud of him and very proud to have gotten to work with him. Again, those of you who are watching the YouTube video, he's the taller one with the goatee. Yeah, Ryan he's just incredible. Joanna too. They both of them, it wouldn't have happened without them. I mean, prior to this, I had done several shorter comics performances, either of my wife Sophie's work or of my own, none of which were rehearsed or as well produced as this. I mean, they were rehearsed, yes, but they were not as rehearsed as heavily. Like, I had a full week of tech and rehearsal to do before I debuted the show on April 12th, 2018. It was just it was so much of a larger production than this. And one of the things that I learned from that is how to make other ways to make comics readings that I do on a smaller scale, like the one that you saw at SwanCon, Chris. How to make those more than just a reading, make them a performance, something that is not just mouthing the words that are on the page, but breathing life into them, acting them, making it into something that's more than that.
So have you found so far that you enjoy performing your own stuff more or somebody else's?
Yes. I'm not really sure, to be quite frank. It's a little bit hard for me to do my own stuff. Like in Boyer's Kiss, there were definitely times during the rehearsal that I felt somebody would question what I would say, what I had written in the script. And I would say, yes, I know what's in the script. I wrote it. I was being too precious with it.
Yeah, I totally understand that.
And there's not, it's not, that's not helpful when you're collaborating with somebody. You know, you can't be, you have to be willing to be flexible, willing to say, I don't understand, but show me what you mean and I can work with you there. But on the other hand of that, when I am adapting someone else's work, like for example, later this year, I am going to be doing a production of between 4 and 6 of my wife, Sophie Goldstein. That's www.redinkradio.com. Sophie Goldstein's science fiction short stories for a stage show, which hopefully I'll be able to take on the road to a certain extent. So I'll be adapting those for a stage show, and that is, it's going to be different because I don't entirely, well, I do have the author readily available and wake up next to her almost every day. I don't necessarily know what her intent is with each one, with each drawing. N'est-ce pas? The closeness that I have with my own work and like the knowledge that there are particular ways that I want lines said because that's the way that I imagine them being said, is both a help and a hindrance. Like, you don't have the same sort of directorial indecision as you might working with somebody else's.
No, I mean, I'm the same way with editing this thing. Like, I can't let anybody edit this podcast. And I mean, it's nowhere near the scale of what you're doing at all, but it's still, this is my baby. And I know what I want to have happen. And I don't think anybody else can do it the way that I want it to have happen.
Yeah. Same sort of thing. I mean, I learned a lot about working with other people through the process of Where's Kiss. There was no possible way that I was going to be able to write, pencil, ink, and do the Photoshop on as many pages as I had to, which is around 110 over the course of a year. Not while working full time, not while like also directing a bloody show, not while like getting ready to get married, for example. I hired my friend Matthew New, shout out to Matthew New, who is also a great cartoonist, to do a lot of the photo editing for me, or a lot of the image editing for me. And I hired my wife to do a lot of the scanning for me. These pages were around 14 by 17 inches. It took a long time. You had to do like 2 separate scans in order to fit them on the bed for that, and then recombine those 2 images in Photoshop later on. And it was big, you know, it was a really big project, and I would not have been able to get it done in the same sort of time frame that I got it done, and if I hadn't had so much really brilliant, really really talented help. I think I may have just walked myself down the rabbit hole again. Did that make sense? Did that answer your question?
No, it does. So in a world where you have unlimited monies to do with this whatever you want, how do you see your perfect show?
My ideal show would probably involve those multiple screens like I was talking about, but maybe not as the only projection surface. I would want to have something where there were smaller screens that would have projections of like reaction panels or projections of like illuminated manuscripts or something like that. Things that we're commenting on and interacting with the main thrust of the narrative. Like if there was a way to tell multiple stories at the same time in the course of a performance, I think that would be a really fascinating experiment. One, two, would be mind-bogglingly difficult, and I would have to hire some very intelligent people to do it for me.
Well, that's why you have unlimited monies.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I would use that for. Additionally, with this ideal show, I would be able to toss copies of this book, like print editions of the book, at attendees. Like I would want to have that included in the ticket price. As nice as it is to be able to touch door money. I feel like, I don't know, I want to give people more. I always want to give people more with the performances and with the comics themselves. Like Where's Kiss, for example, it's based on a 12-panel grid. And I did that not just because I wanted it to be projected on three screens, but also because I wanted it to be a denser, slower read. Like, I want that to be... I don't want my comics to be breezed through the way that you can, like, zip through a manga, like the manga breeze or whatever. I want these things to be... I put a lot of work into them. Every cartoonist puts a lot of work into their comics. And... like, I want them to be things that need to be mulled over. I want people who are reading these to be drawn in and to have to take their time getting through them. And there's ways to do that are probably more intelligent than putting more sad men in little boxes. But maybe I'm not that smart. I don't know. The point is that... Go ahead.
The way you've pulled it off is really good, so...
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate that.
I mean, you're smart enough to do that.
obrigado, senor. So, yeah, what the ideal show would be something that would leave an audience feeling fulfilled. Like, you always leave them wanting more, sure, but... I want the experience of reading and the experience of watching to be distinct enough that when they go back and look at the print book, it's a different experience to the performance. Like there will still be echoes of the performance in their minds, like looking at this. Like I'm sure that when you get around to reading the Where's Kiss like in print edition, you will probably hear Ryan's voice and Joanna's for the characters, but you will not. But it's a separate thing. Like the pleasures of it are separate. Even though the performance is related. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, it's like reading the book versus watching the movie of something.
I mean, literally. The performance aspect or the performance of comics is naturally a live thing, and forces the reader to go at the pace of the performance, right? So if you want to stick around and linger with a drawing on a certain page, you can during a performance because it's live. You have you're being pushed forward by the action of the narrative, and you can't stick around for something unless the creator, whoever they might be, decides to allow you to do so or force you to do so. Whereas reading, like if you see a tree that looks really interesting in a drawing, you can stick around with it for a minute. You could like look at the way that the lines are drawn. You can you can read the artist's intent through the motion of their instrument. In a way that maybe you can't do visually with in a way that you definitely cannot do visually with the live setting.
What has been your favorite piece of Foley work to do during these shows?
There is an amazing piece that I didn't end up using for the one that you saw, but it's a creaky door. And Zach showed us how to make this. It was, we wouldn't have thought of this in a billion years. It's a solo cup, right? And a piece of nylon twine and a dowel, like a wooden dowel, and a little bit of bow rosin. So you put the bow rosin on the dowel. You tie the nylon twine in a loop around that, like a tight little loop around that, and then a knot in the bottom. You poke it through the bottom of the solo cup, and you tie a little knot there, right? And so you stretch it taut, and you turn the you turn the dowel, and it makes this amazing creaky door noise.
See, we're just gonna have to go hunt Zach down now and get him to do it.
Yeah, good luck. I've been trying to hang out with that guy for over a year now. But yeah, he really a master of this kind of this artwork, and I was very blessed to have worked with him. And then also with Bill Rogers, who was the program director at the New Hazlet at the time. He's just moved on from there. And it's just like a solid dude, super, super solid dude.
And what's been the most disgusting piece of Foley work you've had to do?
I definitely found pieces of cantaloupe, in my hair. After part of it, there was maybe six cantaloupes gave their lives in pursuit of this artwork. There we go. You hear that?
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, Zach was just like, oh yeah, I know how to do that. Here you go. The dude just knows.
So he just knows everything, it seems
dude
like.
Dude knows everything, yeah. We talked about audio compression, we talked about bit rates. We talked about clipping, not the band, but the process, like the phenomenon of clipping. And a bunch of other things. Like he recommended getting these little wooden animals off of Amazon. That's a wooden frog called a huiron. And it sounds like a tree frog. Dude knows.
It's kind of creepy how much it sounds like a tree frog.
Right? Is it uncomfortable? That was definitely the grossest thing. There were many brave tomatoes who also gave their lives for this show. I would take two tomatoes and cut them into halves. So I would have, four separate squishes that I would be able to make. And it wasn't until, I want to say, the third or fourth performance that I was like, okay, maybe instead of having four tomato halves, I can just have four tomatoes. They're not expensive. It'll be fine. But trying to make more sound, get more sound out of the half tomatoes, that's not great.
So you have any tour dates or anything coming up if anybody's interested in seeing one of your performances?
Let's see. I'm going to be at a couple of shows in the fall. I'm going to be at CXC. That's Cartoon Crossroads in Columbus, obviously Columbus, Ohio, which is a wonderful show. I'm not real sure about when the dates for that are. I will update my website, which is cantocomics.com, by the way. That's cantocomics.com. I'll be there for that. I'm aiming to get into Staple this coming year in Austin. I say this coming year, but I mean in October. And the performance that I'm doing of Sophie's Comics will be happening in October at the Tulsa Public Library, the main branch in the performance area down in the basement, which is going to be a real hoot and a holler. I'm really excited to get started on that, but I mean we got to go through the casting and all that jazz first.
Yeah, I know. I've kind of been talking to Sophie a little bit about getting her on for one of these episodes too. So I'm excited for when we can pull that off.
Sophie is very smart. She's a very smart and very beautiful lady. I like her a lot. I would be really happy if you did have her on.
Well, her official word has been closer to when something is finished.
Ah, right. Yeah, she has this big thing called an embarrassment of witches, which she's going to have. Her deadline for that is in August, and that's going to be a lot. That's her second book with her writing partner, Jan Jordan. And yeah, if you've not read Dear Reader, if you've not read Sophie's webcomic, Darwin Carmichael is Going to Hell, you can read that on the internet at dcisgoingtohell.com. And it is very, very good. But also, yeah, it's just going to be wonderful. This thing is going to be called The Future. The performance is going to be called The Future Without You. And that is debuting on Thursday, October 24th. At, I'm not sure what time, probably like 7.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be on the website.
Yeah, I'll put that up.
Would that be on Canto Comics as well, or is there a separate site for her stuff?
She has her own site, which is Red Ink Radio. That's redinkradio.com. And yeah, you can read excerpts from a lot of her graphic novels there. And I'm sure she'll be blogging about that at a certain point. I am aiming to start a Patreon this year, which, I mean, surprise, surprise, somebody, a cartoonist is starting a Patreon. So that's going to happen at some point this year. I had started an account for it a couple of years ago, and I just hadn't figured out how to make it work.
Oh, I'm sure you can find a smart lady somewhere in your hometown to help you out with that.
That's true. I may be able to find her in the other room. I don't know how much this is going, the starting a Patreon is actually going to affect my day-to-day life. I assume it will make me blog more often, but I don't know that it's going to change things for me all that much. It'd be really nice to be able to share, to have like a venue to share like some of the not comic stuff that I've done, that I'm doing. And I think the, having that ability and having the ability to like, I don't know, post short video or audio recordings of like grinding pieces of metal together. Or weird sounds that I have found. I think having that as a as an aspect of the Patreon is going to be really helpful for me just as an artist.
I'm really excited to find another way to get to support you because, you know, I can only buy so many copies of the book.
Well, I mean, I've only got so many of them left, to be quite frank. There's only, so I had to, the second volume was printed out of pocket. But that's why the second volume is more expensive. And so I had to print that out of pocket, and it was just like, I could only afford to print around 100-110 of them. I think I'm down to maybe 15 copies. There's also likely to be a Kickstarter at some point in the not terribly distant future to do reprints of a bunch of the other Roodlands stories, including The Pestle, which I've been releasing in a handbound volume for since its completion in 2015. And the other one, like Until the Blood Runs Black, which is the one you saw performed. So I'll be doing those. I'm also going to be finishing up Termring this year, and I suspect I will serialize that on the Patreon as well. There you go. Look out for that, I guess.
I mean, if people want to buy one of your 15 or so copies of the books you have left, where can they go do that right now?
They should go do that right now. You can get those at Canto Comics, oddly, .bigcartel.com. That's CANTOCOMICS .BIGCARTEL.COM. Our shipping rates are agreeable.
I mean, they're good books anyway.
They are good books.
Made by a really cool dude.
Oh, stop. Flattery will get you everywhere. Yeah. So there's that. That's a great place to find them. I'm also on almost everything as Canto Comics. That's CANTO MICS. That's Twitter, that's Instagram, that's there is a Tumblr that is associated with that, but I didn't ever figure out how to make that work properly, so I also, who uses Tumblr?
I'm on the same boat with you on that one.
Yeah. It was really cool for a little bit. I think there were definitely a few things that in my way word youth about Tumblr that I really enjoyed.
Carl, anything else you want to tell everybody before we wrap things up?
I would say that words do have meaning, and that you should be careful about what you say. Don't accuse people of poisoning wells if you don't have a good reason to believe that they have been.
So with that, this has been another wonderful creator guest episode of Play Comics. Next thing in your feed is going to be a regular episode. At this point, I have no idea what it's going to be because I have run out of backlog. So we'll see. I'm sure it's going to be something amazing because I know I've been talking to people. It's just a matter of who gets free time to record with me next. But just remember to grab a game, grab a stack of comics, preferably written by Carl, and go find yourself a new favorite character.